and welcome to Let's Talk, a podcast where I interview professionals for their takes on mental health, addiction, and current events. My name is Dr. Aaron Weiner, a psychologist, addiction specialist, and a guy who is irrepressibly interested in learning about the human condition. I'm your host for Let's Talk, and I hope you'll join me as I explore psychology, medicine, public policy, and how mental health factors into just about everything. My guest for today is Dr. Brian Lekwanen. He's an author, speaker, and practicing psychologist based out of Southern California. He specializes in insomnia and family crisis interventions. However, we have him on the show today to talk about his other area of focus, which is how to help clients who are struggling with highly acute mental health or addiction problems. Dr. Lekwanen actually just published a book called How to Get Your Resisting Loved One into Treatment, a step-by-step guide for mental health and or addiction crises. And I thought it was incredibly useful, very well written, fantastic overview in terms of what a family needs to know, both to help support a loved one who's struggling, how to help maneuver them to a place where they are ready for treatment and change, and then how to support them through that process as well as afterwards. It truly is a fantastic resource, and I'm looking forward to diving into it today on the show. So with that, I hope you enjoy the conversation. Dr. Brian Lekwanen, so glad to have you with me today on Let's Talk.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's good to be here.
Right. Well, so you wrote a book that I'm very interested in called How to Get Your Resisting Loved One into Treatment. And as a fellow addiction practitioner myself, this is an issue. There's a lot of folks who reach out to me via my website or social media even sometimes, very worried about some member of their family. Maybe even if they're kind of writing me on their behalf, almost hoping that they'll take them up on trying to help with their addiction somehow. But they never know what to do. And I'm wondering, is that what inspired you to write this book, being in similar situations, or what motivated you to take on something so huge like writing a book?
Well, the first thing that you'd mention is absolutely one of the big reasons. For the past 15 years or so, I facilitate a group, a support group with the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And I also, for almost 15 years, been working for residential treatment for either adults who are struggling with significant substance use disorders and mental health conditions, along with my private practice. And what I found a lot with working in these family dynamics are that there was missing pieces of knowledge, or they had knowledges, but they were interpreting them in a way that was kind of creating a barrier for them to get treatment. And that's something I can mention in a bit, but it was a lot of these families that were just stuck. They were just stuck. They were hampered by emotions which are legitimate, such as guilt, fear, and feeling helpless and hopeless. And so what I found a lot when working with these families are their concerns, their questions, their inquiries, their struggles were very consistent over time. And what was also consistent over the time working with them were my recommendations and interventions. And I finally realized that with these thematic questions and interventions I've been giving, I said, I need to put this down somewhere, whether it be in a pamphlet, in a book, or something, because I would get family members saying, hey, do you have a slide presentation? Do you have a pamphlet? Do you have this written down anywhere? And I remember very vividly that one family member had asked, hey, you should put this in some type of a guide. And so with any idea, you put it there and it's lingering in the back of your head. And I finally realized, ironically, during the pandemic time when things were slowing down on my clinic level where people were canceling, I finally realized it just came to me on a spring March 2020 day that this is the time. You know, this is the time to do it. I have the time literally to do it, but it just something felt right with doing it. And then 4 years later, here it is. But yes, absolutely. It was how to help these families who felt stuck, but worried that if they don't take action, something really bad can happen. Their loved one can harm themselves, harm others, or put themselves or the families in a situation where things may not be so recoverable. So essentially, yes, that's what it was. And so writing the book, it literally just flowed. It was like this dialogue that I was having with these families. It was very organized in my head already because it was so formulaic. And that's why for 6 weeks, for about 6 to 10 hours a day, I just started typing and just regurgitating mm-hmm. all the different dialogues that I was having with these family members. So yeah, so that's where it initially came from.
Yeah, well, when you see the same pattern repeat itself so many times, things start to crystallize a bit in your mind. And although not every family is different in a lot of ways, there are some very similar themes that tend to echo over and over and over mm-hmm. again. And we are going to talk a bit more about that as we go along. But the bulk of the book is these 25, what you call 25 must knows about what family should know in terms of getting their loved one into treatment and then also being along for the process, which can be very grueling. The first must know that you put in there is just simply that treatment does work. You want the families to know that treatment does work and there is hope. And I know when I read that, the first thought that came into my mind is, one, yes, I agree. You know, I know we're both biased being from that vantage point, we can see that this does work out. But I know there are so many families who are feeling incredibly defeated because they've been working with their loved one for so long. Maybe they've been in and out of treatment several times before. Nothing has gotten them and their loved one over the hump to actually making it to recovery. So how do you work with families who are in that place where they're just really struggling?
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing I tell a lot of the families and what I mentioned earlier is sort of reconceptualizing some of the knowledge they already have. A lot of them already have the knowledge and the skills, but one of the biggest things is reformulating the strategy and skills, the blueprint. You know, there's a saying, you know, that when we keep doing something the same way over and over again, we're going to keep getting the same consequences. And there's another saying I like that nothing changes if nothing changes. So, and that's where I see a lot of it happen is that on the family level, we're so focused on the person who's struggling, which yes, there needs to be change on that person's level as well. But what I see even more importantly is on the family system level, those changes aren't happening. They're not growing at the same rate. They're not recognizing where their share of accountability is and recognizing what their part is and what their role is. And so when someone comes into treatment, the first thing I want to tackle is working with the family unit, because when someone's in treatment per se, it's very difficult, but on some level from a bird's eye view, it's the easy part because they're there because there's level of structure, there's routine, there's accountability, there's a lot of things in place. And it's when they leave there, if they leave back to that same family system, that's where it becomes very challenging. So a lot of times I would find myself doing interventions on the family. Because like I said, if they go and then this is the same dynamic that they're having, same mindset, they haven't grown and changed in the process, then the probability of long-term success dramatically decreases. And if I may mm-hmm. too, when I talk about treatment, yes, there's formal treatment. There's whether it be ranging from a detox to a residential, inpatient, partial hospitalization, intensive outpatient, even seeing a psychiatrist if need be or a therapist on some level, or even going to maybe a 12-step meeting or a church meeting, what have you. So treatment, yes. The reason why this book was written is because it was to capture those people who are in a major crisis mode, that if something doesn't happen, no change takes place, something bad's going to happen. And so treatment is usually the indicated level of care that that person needs, where they need maybe medicine treatment, high degree of structure, routine, accountability. But it also can be formulated to treatments just help. Get your loved one to a point where they just are willing to accept help because there's no options left to wiggle around. And that's where I see a lot of families get stuck. There's options, there's trap doors, whether it be that parent that sort of allows them to be unwell, or that grandparent or grandparents or those friends where they kind of navigate through. And so a lot of it is limiting the options, where the only option on the table is to get better and help. And I also tell family members, and one of my must knows that I talk about, an old major premise of the book is to have hope, is because we lose the fight when we feel like there are no options left. And so that's one of the things I help with families, is to know that there's hope and you could still love your loved ones, but it just has to look a little bit different in terms of the strategies. And that's what I was going to say earlier, concepts, great concepts out there, such as tough love, rock bottom, are well-meaning. But you get a lot of families who misinterpret that. Tough love as meaning tough luck. Like, hey, until you get ready, until you get better, we're done with you. And you can imagine with someone suffering from a major depressive disorder or in a psychotic episode or feeling suicidal, feeling like they're alone, that's going to open the door to helplessness and hopelessness. And so we can still love and care about you, but our love has to be a nice balance between having rules and relationships.
Yeah. Well, and I know we're going to dig around a lot more on that as we chat over the course of this episode, but it really does, I think, require a lens shift. I like how you are framing it as if nothing changes, then nothing changes, because there's a lot that can change internally for an individual, perhaps, but if they're going back to the same system that actually was part of what was locking them in place, then if you ask yourself, so why is this person struggling? If they're, you know, they go off to treatment, things seem like they're working for them, they come back, and then all of a sudden it starts to degrade again. Well, maybe it's not to say that someone doesn't have personal responsibility. Of course they do. But we are so impacted by our social situation and by our surroundings, by our family ecosystem, that there's a lot that that system can do to either hold someone in place or encourage them to grow.
Mm-hmm. Yes, for sure. For sure. And that's what it, a lot of it comes from. And that's why when people are in treatment families, I say you're just as much in treatment as your loved one. And of course, not in the same respects. They're not taken out of their immediate surroundings and so forth, but they're still in this recovery process. And recovery to me, by the way, is just a planted place, an intentional planted place for better outcomes, better living. So we are all in some form of recovery. And so in that treatment or recovery process is this all hands deck approach. And what that does to the loved one struggling, and I see it repeatedly, when they know their loved ones are also changing and growing and with them in that process, it really, really changes their perspective. It really dramatically increases their level of hope. It really instills that level of optimism that, hey, I'm not all in this alone. I believe in the work that I do with families, sometimes there's a natural inclination for us to believe that the level or the degree of harm or hurt that one's caused is correlated to the degree of amends they have to make. Well, you've been doing this for decades, so you got to do most of the work. And that is one thing that I tackle with family members. And one of the things I'll talk about, the primary system, is those identified members in the loved one circle or the family unit who are going to be fully engaged in this process. And I tell them, there's a saying, you hadn't caused it, you can't cure it, you can't control it, but you've perpetuated this issue in some form or fashion. And so when there's a group of maybe four family members, I tell them, if you're not invested and not willing to make the change, grow inward, then don't be part of this process. Maybe later on down the road, you will be. But if you are willing to be part of this system and this change, for four family members, you have to assume and accept 25% responsibility and work 100% on your 25%. And that could go for couples who are divorcing, whether a spouse was engaging in infidelity. We think, oh, that spouse that created the infidelity or caused the infidelity, they have to do most of the work. And then what it creates is this very, very imbalanced struggle where we can never catch up and the person ends up feeling helpless and then resentful. And so it's definitely a community involved system where everyone takes responsibility and work 100% on whatever that shared responsibility is.
Yeah, well, and that dynamic of someone who's been in an addiction, just constantly feeling like, well, what rights do I have? Or how can I request that things be any different? Or just feeling less than. It ultimately is disempowering. And really what we're trying to do in treatment is help someone feel as if they can do it. They can change. And also to change their perspective sometimes on, like you were mentioning before, on boundaries and relationships and how this interplay works. And so this could be a good bridge. I know that in your book, and you alluded to it a second ago as well, you're not a fan of the phrase tough love. And that's, I think, very evidence-based. I'm with you on that. But you do advocate for something that you call assertive love.
Yes.
What is assertive love? How does that differ from tough love? And why are we trying to shift from one to the other?
With what the families come with me, what I mentioned earlier, tough love, meaning that it's all of a sudden this wall that they create, this barrier that, hey, at all costs, I'm done with you, right? I'm done with you. And that's, they're well intended, saying that we're not supporting this lifestyle, but there's just different ways we can say that. And so for me, where I look at assertive love means, to me, some of the best relationships that I've ever encountered, and I would say this on a very global level, are the healthiest relationships are ones where you have a balance between having rules and relationships. So relationship means that level of closeness, intimacy, you know, the bondness that you have. And rules are some of these boundaries, right? So maybe you have a best friend or a spouse who you've been together with, right? There's if you have a successful marriage and a relationship, I can almost guarantee you there's a nice balance or symbiosis between having rules and relationship. For example, you are connected with each other. You learn each other about each other on a deeper level. You care about each other and all those, you know, different emotions where you stay connected. But there's also rules, ways of how to treat each other, you know, what to say to each other, being mindful and respectful of each other. And so, like I said, in any healthy, productive relationship where there's reciprocity, which is give and take, there's a nice balance between those two. And that, I talk about that balance with people on any level. It could be a coworker to coworker, a boss to an employee, best friends to friends, a parent to a child. And if you really think about that, there's that nice balance. And that's where assertive love comes from. And so assertive love, when I tell with families, is say, hey, we're going to always be here and care for you. We just can't support this unhealthy lifestyle any longer because we are doing more harm than good when we give you that permission or minimize the struggle that you're going through. And so that's where the assertive boundaries come. A lot of times families say, well, we're not going to love them anymore. We're going to communicate. We're not going to love them. No, we're going to give them the option that here's where we are, but this is just where we're willing to support, not support. And and that's kind of, it puts the responsibility or gives the other person an option, because what I've learned is when you take away options from anybody, they resist. Mm-hmm. And I saw that a lot in the past 4 years when people were asked to stay home, and all they were doing when I was working with them was staying home. And all of a sudden, they want to go out. I said, why? Well, now they're telling us to stay home. And so I've seen a lot of that human reaction, that when we're limited in choices, we feel fearful or threatened. And so that's what I'm telling the family unit, is saying, no, we're here for you. This is what we're going to be here for, when you're willing to accept help or make that change.
Right. I know a lens that I like to use when I talk with families about this is that of, what actions can I take that will move someone towards ultimately what their goals are for their life, which generally is not being mired in an addiction. And sometimes it can be counterintuitive, where you think like, oh, I don't want this, but I don't want my loved one to feel pain or discomfort or have to incur this consequence. When in fact, actually, like you were mentioning a second ago, that minimizing of earned suffering, I forget the exact words that you were using, but I like to use the word natural consequences. Someone does something, there would be natural consequences that would come from that action. But if someone steps in front of them and essentially takes that brunt, they don't feel the consequence, they may not be motivated for change. And is that kind of what you're saying with the idea of assertive love, that there's certain things that you'll be there for, that you'll support, that you might even protect them from, but others where if someone's going to make that choice, they have to live with those consequences?
Well, yeah, exactly. And that's a tough part. And that's exactly where families stay stuck. And I said, we'll talk about it, but you know, when we define disease, right, there's a medical and psychiatric definition of disease. And I know there's different thoughts of a disease and what it means. And so the way I generalize disease, yes, there's diabetes is a disease, you know, depression can be looked at as a disease, but I communicate disease being a more global term that we can all relate to. It's any entity or entities that's we struggle with, and it's been chronic, right? So things like selfishness. There's not a medical diagnosis for selfishness or psychiatric diagnosis for selfishness. Having too much pride, you know, being envious of people, you know, those are, if that racism, right? I don't think there's a medical diagnosis for racism, but if it's that entity that you struggle with, then that's your version of disease. And so that's why I say we're all in some form of recovery as well, is a lot of times is we are trying to mitigate respecting the capabilities of our own diseases. I do use that same terminology, natural implications or consequences. And I do believe sort of a side note, but really related, is I believe that there's been a major shift where we are not allowing people in our lives, especially for kids, to not experience the natural consequences of behaviors. I remember there was this news article that I came across. It was about a father who rushed to school saying, "Hey, can I see my daughter?" And they're like, "What's wrong?" He's, "I just need to see my daughter. She's in the third grade." And so they call the teacher. The teacher comes in and will say, "Mr. Smith, hey, Mr. Smith, what's going on?" He goes, "Oh, my daughter forgot her cooler of water. Can you please give this to her?" And what they name that type of interaction that's been going on is the lawnmower parent, lawnmower like cutting the lawn, is that what they do is they take out all these obstacles from people because they don't want the person to see them struggle. It's a lot of discomfort that they internalize. And to me, you know, discomfort is huge. I believe it is the fodder for growth. Is, you know, anything that you do, anyone who's successful, is it not because they traveled through mediocrity or never everything was comfortable. It's they've strained and reached a level of a threshold of discomfort. That's the whole part of dealing with in vivo exposure and therapy. That's with an athlete improving their athleticism or strength. That's when using a yoga pose over time as you increase that threshold. And so for sure is to a reasonable degree, right? You wouldn't let a 4-year-old touch a red hot oven to accentuate the belief that don't touch that. But you would maybe talk to them about it or maybe feel it from a distance. But I do believe that natural consequence of behavior, and I talk about it, is we would never imagine seeing our loved one being in a jail, hospital, or homeless. But on this level, when someone's struggling, those can be some of the most important springboards for them to reach a level of desperation where they accept help. And one thing I want to talk about too, if you don't mind, is I talk about the three inevitable consequences to continued untreated mental health or substance use disorder that are at a high level. Is I tell families all the time, and a lot of this is also taken from different recovery arenas, but untreated mental health or addiction that's at a high level, that person is either going to end up in jail, hospital, or they're going to lose their life. Homeless is temporary, but eventually, if they stay at that unhealthy level, they'll end up in jail, hospital, or lose their life, or take someone else's life in some direct or indirect way. And I tell families is you will never accept, you're a parent, I'm a parent myself, is we would never accept emotionally ever outliving our children, but we have to accept the reality. Because what happens is family members stay stuck. Oh, my daughter, I know she's upstairs. I know she's drinking alcohol and taking painkillers, but as long as she's not in the street being abused. I know my grandson is at home in his apartment alone and not using the money for college, but he's using it for an excessive marijuana use. What we don't realize is, number one, that daughter can die up there from an overdose. That son can be in a situation. But the longer they stay in that unhealthy state, the harder it is to break those patterns and unwire those patterns. And so absolutely, natural consequences to a degree is very important. And I think we've come to a point where we don't want anyone, our loved ones, to suffer or be too uncomfortable. And that's, to me, a very important part of insight and growth.
Yeah. Well, for sure. I mean, particularly if when it comes to addiction, so much of that behavior is looped around coping, right? Wanting to feel okay, wanting to not feel uncomfortable. And so if that's how someone is perceiving that behavior, why would they change if they weren't uncomfortable doing it? You know, there has to be some reason for change. Otherwise, it feels like it's still working for them. I think, though, that the difficult nuance with all of this for families, and this is where having a guide like your book or like a professional is so helpful, is being able to tease apart. So like you were mentioning, you don't want to encourage a child to touch a hot stove so they learn, because they might hurt themselves extremely badly, or there might be some permanent consequence or damage. And I think that's where things get very tricky sometimes with this is to say, sure, you know, there are some very uncomfortable consequences. What we don't want, though, is for them to die. We don't want some like massive lasting trauma. We don't want. So how do we, or infectious disease or whatever it is. So how do we create those natural consequences while still providing a very clear pathway towards healing if someone decides at any point that's what they really want? And I think that's what, again, one of the hardest but most important aspects, and please feel free to disagree if you'd like, but is the idea that there's got to always be a channel where they know that you're there for them if what they want is to move towards health. But at the same time, if they want to continue down a pathway that's destructive, they need to be able to see, oh, well, this is destructive. Like, this is actually, I'm making a choice to turn away from my family, to turn away from these folks, to do this one particular type of behavior. Mm-hmm. And that's not taking me where I actually want to go.
Exactly. And that's where the healthy boundary setting is. I always imagine in one of my first offices when I started working at a treatment facility, it was on a smaller, it was in one room, and there was literally two doors. One was the doctor's door and one was the therapist door. And we would sit in a group and I would imagine them, tell them that, imagine you're standing in the middle of those two doors and one door is the unhealthy life. The other door on the right is the healthy life. And you're eventually, when you're going to meet that point of desperation, you're going to have a choice. But what's behind that door are certain experiences. On the unhealthy door, they have a lot of data of what's behind that door. There's unhealthiness. For some people also, there's good stuff, right? There's some good stuff that could come along with it, whether it be making money and accessibility to things and feeling great, but there's also destruction. What's lacking, though, on the right door, they don't have much yet when they're unwell. They don't see that there's hope and promise and that there's relationships. There's a lot of positivity. And that's where that boundary setting is going to be really important, where they realize, like, wow, I have a great family. I have a great support system. Mm-hmm. I have a career that I can still accomplish. And that's what that eventually does, is when they're faced to make a choice, hopefully at one point they're saying, I'm done with this lifestyle here on the left side. I want to give this lifestyle a chance. And the only way that can happen is on the family level, is that we create some data to recognize what they can be a part of, because they don't see that. If you have a family that's disconnected from them, where's the hope to get better? This is all I know on the left side. This is all I know. This is what I'm comfortable with. So what's there to work towards? And I call that planting the emotional seeds. It's one of my must-knows. Even your loved one struggling, that simple text saying, hey, we love you and care about you. When you're ready to get ready, we're here for you. And then, mm-hmm. and if you remember in the book, I talk about this mom who actually set a boundary to her son who was struggling with heroin use. And he talked about it in treatment with us, is that she would text him all the time at night when he's about to get high saying, hey, I love you. I miss you. And he said it was the ultimate buzzkill. It was the ultimate buzzkill where he's about to get high. And here's his mom telling, I love you. I miss you. But eventually it was those collection of texts and those messages that helped him realize in a moment of clarity that, wow, I have people that love me and I have people who are going to be there for me. And that's what eventually got him into that place where he's about to accept help, is that on that right door, he knows what he can gain and what he's missing out on.
Yeah. Well, and I love that example too, because I think it really highlights this again, nuance. It's so difficult sometimes for folks to see where they land in it, but where you can be loving and present, but also have boundaries that are healthy and motivate someone towards change. It's not just like someone is completely cut off. They understand that there is something out there for them, and it's possible to move towards that if they want to. The struggle, I think, when I imagine that scenario too, right? And as we now currently think about addiction, you know, it's not just a choice. I know we've said the word choice a lot today, but I know we're both on the same page that what, you know, addiction, it's a biopsychosocial, and some people would also add on spiritual mm-hmm. problem that people are facing, right? Yep. It's not just something where people can be like, you know what, today I'm done with heroin, or today I'm done with alcohol, and just have that stick. It's actually pretty complicated to get somebody out. So being able to have compassion that someone's really caught in a web, and it might take them some time to get out, or even multiple attempts when they really want to get out, to successfully mm-hmm. get out. But continue to both be emotionally available when someone's moving towards health, while at the same time allow there to be the right level of natural consequences so that someone's motivated for change.
Exactly. Exactly. And I call it the four pillars. And I do believe, you know, when we are successful in life, we are attending to the four main areas. And when we're not successful, we're not attending to one or more of those areas. And you mentioned it, it's the physical, the mental / emotional. I call it the social health, or like jobs, career, relationships. And then there's the spiritual part. And just to clarify, spiritual is not necessarily a higher power or God. It definitely can be, but also can relate to someone's deeper purpose and meaning and more of that existential part. And so, those four areas are consistent that differentiates people who continue to be successful in the recovery process and not successful.
Yeah. No, it's like any one of them. You know, if someone doesn't have that sense of purpose, say, but even the other ones are there, that can bring them back. So speaking of bringing back, one of the distinctions that you make in the book that I think is definitely important in this process of recovery, which is rarely a straight line, is the difference between someone having a lapse and someone having a relapse. What's the difference between those things? Because I think a lot of the time when folks aren't immersed in this world very much, they just know about relapse and they don't know about the difference between the two.
Well, that came up a lot as well. And this was a terminology that I'd come across as well. But I also started to think about the families. Because when I'm in the treatment process, you get a lot of families, you know, you get loved ones that stay in treatment with us for 45, 60, 90 days, 120 days if they're stepping down to partial hospitalization, intensive outpatient, sometimes a year. And let's say 3 months out, their loved one engages in marijuana use, if that was their drug of choice, or alcohol, or what have you, or they get manic. And that's something that they've been struggling to do because they got off their medication. Then you get a lot of these family members that say, oh my God, this was a waste of time, a waste of money. Here we are doing it again. And they feel they lose faith in the process. But one thing I asked them is, I said, well, prior to treatment, prior to all this work that you did, where would your loved one be prior to it when they engaged in alcohol or they engaged in marijuana use? Play that tape forward. And they would say, well, they would end up using heroin again. They would start to get depressed and isolate, may even make a suicide attempt, or they get in a psychotic episode and end up in jail, or they end up in the hospital, mental health, psychiatric ward. But what's the difference now? The difference now is, well, yes, they engage in THC, but they were able to get back in place because they have a therapist, they have a psychologist, psychiatrist, they have a fellowship. And so relapse on a very general level is a big fall. That's how I conceptualize it. And a lapse is more of a slip. And so but the high correlation I have between those is the strength and quality of someone's recovery program. So remember, recovery is anyone's intentional plan and place for living. One person's recovery program may look different than the other person, but I also believe there are consistent attributes and characteristics in general, like things like honesty, being open to direction, having healthy fellowship. But also there's different things that differentiate one person's recovery over another. But I believe that the strength of recovery program can mitigate or differentiate between a relapse and lapse. And so relapse is more of this trajectory. If you recall in the book, I use an EKG that, so if someone doesn't have things like a strong recovery program could be, they have a lot of accountability in place, healthy fellowship. For example, they're connected with a therapist. Maybe they're going to some type of support meetings. Maybe their family dynamic is healthy and growing as well. They have a lot of coping mechanisms. But when they don't have those things in place, they try to, I call white knuckling it. They're, okay, I'm going to stop using alcohol, but I don't have anything in place. No fellowship, no accountability. And a stressor happens, they dip. They dip really low. But without all those things in place, a fellowship, coping mechanisms, anyone holding them accountable, the climb back up here is hard. They could stay down here for a long time. Sometimes something bad can happen. They come in jail, attempt their life, they die. But the climb back up here without a recovery program is a long crawl or climb. And if they still don't have a strong recovery program, they go along, quite white knuckling it, and a stressor happens, boom, they dip. A stressor could be a job loss, financial stress, a divorce. Okay. And so that's the trajectory, I believe, of a relapse.
I almost feel like when you're giving that example, I almost think about it like someone wearing like a life preserver in the water, right? Mm-hmm. Like if they can't swim, like you push down, you might be under there for a while. Yeah. But if you're wearing that life jacket, if you have the strong recovery program, you're going to pop right back. You're going to go under the water at first because something's pushing you down, but you'll come right back up again.
Yeah. That's a great analogy as well. And that's kind of very, very similar. And on the contrary, a lapse is usually with someone has a strong recovery program, they have all those things in place. And say, for example, let's say you are sober and all of a sudden maybe you have a loss of a family member through death, and maybe they relapse on a substance, but then they get reconnected with their fellowship, they have accountability, they have these coping mechanisms. So it becomes, instead of a deep fall, it becomes more of a little blip, but they're able to come back up. Mm-hmm. And that is what I see, and that it tells family members, that gives them hope that yes, the process did work. And I don't like to normalize that lapses are inevitable. Of course, we don't want any lapses, but normalize to the sense that it's not a failure. And I look at it as data information to work with. And so that is the major difference between a lapse and a relapse. And so it's on the family level, the individual level, to know, hey, I didn't fail. I can still come out of this. But also on the family level as well, to know that that is a potential part of the process. And hopefully they don't have any lapses moving forward.
Yeah, well, you make a really good point there about it. And that's always tricky, right? How do you handle lapses? How do you set a frame where it's not like you're planning to not meet your goals at X amount of times a month or a year, but more that if you do have one of those moments, because they do happen frequently for a lot of people, like something's going to happen, how fast can you bounce back from it? And that's actually, I have a very mixed opinion about counting days, because I think that they can be very motivating, but they can also be very demotivating if anything is to happen. Like you're saying, oh man, like 120 days out the window, or 90 days out the window, or or whatever it is. When actually, like, if you look at it, someone's probably gained a tremendous amount from that period of time. So much, so many experiences, skills, cravings resisted, so much along the way. And if you look at, say, percentage of, say, drinking days over the last 6 months, if someone drank like one day in 6 months compared to where they were before, it's probably like a night and day, such a positive shift, right? And so it's about how is it framed? Can it still be a pathway to the sort of stable, healthy life that they're looking for, even if it is just a slip? Or is it something that really knocks them off their horse or pushes them underneath the water, whatever metaphor we want to use?
Yeah. And with that too is, yes, I'm not a huge number person with numbers, is because you're right, because it's like, my God, I had 10 years under my belt and this was all for nothing and so forth. Where I mention sometimes is that I believe there's a correlation between time correlated to someone's motivation. Is there's a saying that I came across, is the harder you work at something, the harder it is to give it up, right? Whether it be a relationship, a marriage, a job. The variety as well is that when you work for something, it's like, wow, there's a difference, I believe, between someone who's 24 hours sober versus 24 days, someone who's sober 1 month versus 6 months, you know, 6 months versus 6 years, is because the harder you worked at something, the harder it is to give it up. And I believe, and I tell people all the time, is just that's where that one day at a time concept is, because as they're distancing some of themselves from that unhealthiness, they realize the process it took to get there. And think of anything in any of our lives that we've worked so hard for, your degree, for your family to put together, we'll fight for that. And that's what it's saying, is we're fighting for that, for to protect, and we're fighting against that, getting back to that old place. And so that's where that comes with me, is the more time you clock in, the more you distance yourself from that unhealthiness, but the more you're willing to fight for it because you put in the work to get there.
Yeah, I feel like that's the good part about the number, right? It can be incredibly motivating. So like, can you use that paradigm and get all the good out of it while shaving off at least some, if not all the bad? But before we're out of time, we've got maybe about 10 minutes left. There's a couple other areas I really wanted to ask you about, because it, as far as I can tell, I think you invented these ideas. And so I really like them, or at least you put the words to them. And one that I really liked was your H2O model, appealing from addiction. I was like, oh, that's a really nice, we're talking about water a lot today. But tell us a little bit, what does H2O stand for? How does it lower the risk of having a lapse or relapse if you have that in recovery?
Yeah. And then so to back up a little bit as well is in my book, you're not going to see a bunch of statistics. There's not all these statistics out there studying research or anything like that, because I want it to be somewhat of a timeless manual, because depression 50 years ago is very similar to depression today. 50 years from now, depression is going to be very similar. So is substance use disorder. So is bipolarity, meaning that the disease is still, that those symptoms are still going to look the same. Treatment modalities, maybe psychiatric medications may change and so forth over time, but the manifestation of that disease is still going to be the same. And so that's why I want to be a timeless manual, so someone could pick this up years, maybe decades later, and be like, wow, it's still pertinent and relevant. The reason why I say that with in terms of the research as well is what I did a lot was find what are some of the most thematic attributes that I continue to see among the hundreds or maybe in the thousands of clients on group levels and family, hundreds of family dynamics and so forth on different levels of acuity, of what differentiates between those people who progress and don't progress, right? Successful doesn't mean, hey, they're completely sober and they'll have no issues. No, it's just that they're progressing where they want to progress. And so there's many attributes that came across between differentiating those two who are progress, not progress. But the three most salient and robust ones were these three that came up with H2O. We all know what H2O is. It's essential for life. It's water. But H2O stands for me, is honesty, humility, and open to direction. Three of the most robust elements. And to this day, whenever I ask someone why they struggled, no one has ever said that they were high, meaning high level on all of those things, but they were still struggling. They were deficient in one or more of those. And people who are successful to this day are very high in attending to all three of those. So number one, honesty. Honesty is, I believe, the most prominent factor and the impetus for change. Because if you're not honest with yourself and others, you're harboring secrets. You harbor secrets, those turn into resentments. Resentments are unresolved anger. And almost always resentments point back, no matter what you've been through, who harmed you, they turn back at yourself. Okay. So you have to be transparent and honest with yourself and others. The other one is humility, for people who aren't familiar with where the root word comes from. Humility comes from byproduct of having been humiliated. Hence, become humbled or have humility. And where I say that is also humility is not having pride or ego. But how I also look at humility is respecting what you're up against, whether it be hiking in the mountains. If you're a hiker and you disrespect Mother Nature, you know, you don't have enough battery life, or you know, disrespect the terrain, or I don't need much water, I've been here thousands of times before, or you're a deep sea cave diver and, hey, I didn't check my equipment, I've done this hundreds of times. We know what I'm saying is when we disrespect the capabilities of something, it's going to get us in the end. And so humility is respecting that disease that we're up against. Alcoholism, depression, whatever we're struggling with, is because at any time, if we stop disrespecting his capabilities, it's going to get us. It's going to come alive and disempower us. And the last one is open to direction, right? Is because if we're humble enough, we're open to direction and recognizing that what we've been doing hasn't been working. So that's open to direction, recommendations, insights. Those three qualities, I tell clients all the time, if on a 1 to 10 scale, 10 being very high, 1 being very low, if you're 9 and above in all of those, I guarantee you that you're doing well. If you dip below any of those, you need to do whatever it takes to get back to that high level. So I go to the point of a disease vaccine, is those three elements are what mitigates, manage the disease that we're struggling with: honesty, humility, open direction.
Yeah. No, and that's why I wanted to make sure we had some time to talk it through here on the podcast, just because I think there's that was one of those sections of the book that when you read, it's like, wow, like that just has a truthy ring to it. But it's often so hard to take these ideas and concepts and make it simple, which I don't mean in any pejorative way, but a lot of times it's easy to get caught up in all the details. Yeah. But if you can just boil it down to three things, much less with a catchy way of remembering it, it's a lot more likely to stick. So fantastic. So again, just almost out of time today. So I want to ask a couple more here forward looking in the process, because you do devote some of your book, not just towards, well, what happens, how do we get a loved one even to go to treatment, but then what next, right? Where do you send them? And then what happens afterwards? So let's start with the first half of that. Say you've got someone who has decided, I don't want to live this lifestyle anymore. I'm ready for a shift. Then what? Because there are so many pitfalls in terms of knowing where to go for help or who to ask. I mean, even when you go online and type in anything, you're going to get bunches of ads that people have paid probably millions of dollars to have that be, which doesn't necessarily mean quality or that it's right for you. Yeah. How do you guide families towards pushing them towards a direction that's a good fit rather than getting snared by any of these traps?
Yeah, for sure, for sure. And number one, there's a lot of legitimate organizations out there that I mentioned also in the book that that I've involved with in some form or fashion. So there's a lot of good organizations. But yes, absolutely, you have to be your biggest voice, whether you're on the family level or individual level. Yeah, unfortunately, there are some places where they are smoke and mirrors, right? And that's why we have to do a vetting process on the family level. And also on the individual level, I think one of the best things to do is if there's a professional in the family or connected with seeing a therapist, definitely look at the resources from within, whether it be family members, referrals, friends of friends. That would be the best place to start. And asking, and with social media, right? Depending on someone's comfort level, you could definitely ask, like, hey, I have someone who is really struggling with mental health conditions or alcoholism. Anybody have any ideas? And I've gotten a lot of recommendations for various things on a neighborhood app or on a social media, Facebook or Instagram. And so really look at the tools that within you have. Then, like I said, that's referrals within your own family or people, friends of friends, or on a social media level. And then, of course, the on professionals that you're connected with, you know, your doctors, therapists, school counselors. But there's a lot of different websites, right? The National Alliance on Mental Illness is a huge organization in the United States and worldwide that provides education, support, groups for people, but also a great resource. The World Health Organization definitely is another one. The Depression Bipolar Support Alliance. So there's a lot of organizations out there where you can start. That's where I talk with the family unit. There's, you know, I know treatment, but there's a lot of administrative components that make it difficult, but be finances and insurances and so forth to navigate. That's why it's a really come together process to look at what are resources, what do we have available, what's needed, you know, because not everyone is going to need formal treatment. They may not be at that level. Like, hey, let's start up with a therapist. Maybe for some people, if it works for them, a SMART recovery, a 12-step recovery, that may be the thing, but there's all kinds of help out there. But that's where I would say is start with from what you're with within your toolbox and expand from there.
That's great advice. I know for me, I've had to do a little bit of the searching myself of late, because I work nationally now under SIPAC, which is an interjurisdictional compact for psychologists, and a lot of times there's someone who I really feel needs a higher level of care, and I have no idea what's around them in terms of that higher level of care. And so I end up having to do a lot of this poking around myself. Mm-hmm. And the first place that I go, and this is something that I recommend to folks as well, if they're looking for their own loved ones or friends or whoever it is to, like you said, ask a professional in the area, because they know, you know, like I'm Chicago, I'm based out of Chicago. I absolutely know who I like, who I send to in this area. I've got a referral base. Anyone who's been practicing in an area for, you know, few years at least, knows who they like and can explain to you why, and usually would be happy to tell you free of charge, you know, because it's not hard to give those recommendations. So that, and then also just the one that comes to mind that we haven't touched on yet that I would want to put out there is a third party accreditation. If you're looking again at the treatment side of things, you know, like Joint Commission, CARF, you know, that just to make sure there's that floor of quality and they've taken that step to get accredited. But as a last thing for today, you know, here then on this end of the stage of change, we've talked about prior to them going to treatment, we've talked about selecting treatment. So then another major hurdle for families is how do you handle almost, it's like a reintegration when someone who has been perhaps modeling a lot of unhealthy behaviors, say they do go away. I know we've talked about treatment in a number of levels, residential, outpatient, et cetera, but let's say they go off to residential treatment and now they're coming home. And there might be some degree of trepidation. There might be some question of like, how do we behave? How do they behave? What should families do, generally speaking, of course, to support that process of change moving forward? And are there things in particular they should avoid?
Well, absolutely great question as well. And one of the things I talk about based on families' questions of inquiries is a phase of recovery process. And one of the things that I'm a big believer in, and I use the example, if you recall, of someone who was in the ICU, the intensive care unit, at the wing of the hospital where something drastic has happened. And then say, for example, someone had a stroke, right? Someone had a stroke, they are really in a bad place and they're in the intensive care unit. People just don't go right back home and engage in the same level of activity, going to the gym, working 50 hours a week. No, what do? They have a step down level of care to maximize their success. Depending on what level of stroke the person experienced, they may go through occupational therapy, speech therapy, physical rehab, and that's to maximize their success. But what happens a lot is where people struggle is they'll end up in the intensive care unit because they made an attempt on their life. They had a drug overdose. They had a psychotic episode and were wandering the freeway system. And so they're in a 3-day hold, 2-week hold, and they go back home. And without a step down level of care. So that would probably look like a residential care. And from residential care is going to be something like a partial hospitalization because there's certain attributes involved in that process. And I call it structure. Structure meaning the organization to a day, routine are these activities that you engage in personally, and accountability are these entities that can hold you responsible and accountable. And so one of the things I would recommend anybody, as long as you know it works resource-wise, is if you're in a residential level of facility, to do a step down level of care, even for a little bit. I call it the warm transition or softer landing. Because what happens is you get this deer in the headlight look. Here they are in a program, their day is structured, and they go back home and there's no one around and there's no, what am I doing? There's these gaps of activities and then boredom sets in. And we know that when people are really struggling with a disease, boredom can be the impetus or the gateway to unhealthy coping mechanisms. But in addition to that, if there's available step-down level care, I highly recommend that. I look at 1 year as the most sensitive early recovery process, especially if you've had a suicide attempt or you were hospitalized, is because it could take that long time for the body to change, to break patterns on the family level, individual level. But if they are coming back home and that's not an option, I would really, really be patient with the loved ones and set new goals, what expectations are, everyone working 100% on their share, and kind of reacquainting yourself with one another. We get a lot of spouses that are there and they come back home. I said, you have to date yourselves all over again because the person's different. There's been an identity shift on an individual level and the family level. And so I think it's a gradual process, slowly integrate that. And I used to work with veterans who were deployed in Afghanistan and Iraq, and they just jump back into the family of where they were, but lots of change, right? The whole system has changed without their presence. They have changed in their experiences, so has the family. And so this warm transition integration is being very reasonable with expectations and having really heavy, open, intimate, open dialogue and reevaluate what the goals are and the expectations on an individual and a family level.
So it sounds like the crux of it is be open, ask questions, talk a lot, and whatever needs to be there in terms of structure. Make sure the person's supported because they're changing, you're changing. We gotta just take it one day at a time.
And maintain those rules and relationships.
Yeah. All right. Well, my goodness, this time absolutely flies. I feel like we could probably talk. I mean, we've barely scratched the surface of your book. There's so much good stuff in there. Is there any thought or message that you'd like to leave listeners with today in terms of this process of engaging the family around the process of change?
Yes. Well, like I mentioned before, is don't give up hope, right? I've seen the most dire of cases. I've had clients who made an attempt on their life 48 hours before coming to treatment. Have had people who were homeless and psychotic and able to get sober to this day. And so stay in the fight and have hope, right? We have to revisit the strategies and just know that 99% of the families I've ever worked with were coming from a good place. Doesn't mean you come from a good place, is it's the right place, right? Or the best place. And that's what we have to be humble enough to recognize, but we could still use that love and care. It just needs to look differently. And we have to change the blueprint to how we're approaching it. But like I said, maintain, stay in it, stay in the fight. And they need you. They need you. They're struggling. They may tell you they don't need you, but that's that disease fighting. That's what you want to shut down. But look past that. You take away that disease, I guarantee your loved ones, smart, funny, ambitious, loving. And I see that all the time with family members. I tell them to brag about their loved ones, and it really is an emotional response for them, or also the individual struggling. I said, tell your peers about something that you've accomplished, and you'd be amazed of the level of what they've accomplished, but this disease has really, really infiltrated and taken over. And so just recognize that's part of the sickness, that's where the fight is, and stay in the game, and you can get your loved one back.
Yeah. Oh, what a great message of hope to end things on. And I just want to underscore, there is so much that you wrote about in the book that has such tremendous value. And I think sometimes folks are resistant themselves, perhaps, to picking up a book, thinking that, like, I should know this, or, you know, is it self, but it's really not. And there's so much that you can learn from a book like the one that you wrote that's not self-evident, which is why you took it upon yourself to write the book. Because if this was something that came naturally to families, that came naturally to people, you wouldn't have had all these conversations over the years. I feel like, you know, COVID hit, you wrote a book that will probably be useful for about 3 decades. I got a puppy or two. I'm not sure. your approach to it, probably better for humanity. My approach to it, probably better for my kids. But, you know, it's all a worthwhile way to spend the time when you're locked in. But thank you again for writing a fantastic book. Thanks again for coming on the show.
Hey, Dr. Weiner, thank you so much. And I appreciate all that you're doing out there in the field of work. And it's impactful. It's not going anywhere. And I really appreciate the message and allowing this platform to reach a lot of the people out there. So I also want to throw that back at you and all the stuff that you're doing as well.
I appreciate it. Thanks again to Dr. Brian Lekwanen for coming on the show today. And as always, to you for listening in. If you'd like to get in touch with Dr. Lekwanen, you can reach him through his website at drbrianlekwanen.com. If you'd like to get in touch with me, feel free to visit my website at weinerphd.com or drop me a line at aaron@weinerphd.com anytime. Today's episode was written and produced by me, Aaron Weiner. Audio editing was provided by Lorenzo. Intro and outro music was composed by Atch. Thanks again for listening, and I hope you'll choose to join us again next time for Let's Talk. If you enjoyed today's show, make sure to subscribe to keep up to date on new episodes and to follow me on Facebook, LinkedIn, and YouTube to participate in new episodes as they air. Take care, and I look forward to our next conversation.